Good evening, Dick. K2RAW, Nanette, W2RAY. I do have a question. I was making some measurements, reference the adjacent channel problem I was having, and I came up with some results, and I'd just like to throw them away because something doesn't seem to make too much sense. Okay, go right ahead with your question. Well, okay, I'll tell you about the results first, and then I'll ask the question. I made a measurement into a repeater receiver, a commercial receiver, where I got a particular SINAD level, a 12 dB SINAD level of, say, -115 to the receiver itself. I put an adjacent channel signal in until I made that 12 dB SINAD level degrade by about approximately a reading of 1 dB on the instrumentation. That level happened to be about 47 dB higher than the signal I was putting in, approximately 47 dB higher. Now, the last time I asked you, said, try putting your levels in higher. I made the SINAD go up by a substantial amount by increasing the initial generator by 10 dB. Then I increased the alternate generator by 10 dB. And again, I started seeing a degradation when it approached about 10 dB higher from its previous level. I repeated that three times because after 30 dB on the initial receiver, the SINAD went up to a reading of 28 on my service monitor, and it wouldn't go any higher. So that means I was into saturation as far as the receiver was concerned. It wouldn't display anything stronger. My question is, how can you realistically determine before I answer the question, let me tell you what else I did. I took one generator and I moved it from in frequency by about 150 megahertz. Now, and I put a cavity that had a bandwidth of about maybe 3 meg from the set frequency, 1.5 either way, and it had a roll-off of about maybe 20, 25 dB at 10 meg, but about 70 dB by the time it went up about 470 megahertz. It dropped down significantly. So that meant that my alternate signal I was putting in was very, very reduced by going 150 megs out of band. As that generator introduced a signal level of about -30 dBm, the noise from that generator apparently was enough to upset the SINAD reading at its initial low-level reading. My question is, how do you actually determine adjacent channel selectivity if you can't be absolutely certain that your test equipment isn't introducing noise into the situation and upsetting your readings? Because it doesn't match anywhere near what the specification for the manufacturer states in the equipment.
Yeah, Todd, good question. Before I proceed, the manufacturer told you you should have 60 or 70, some great big number, of adjacent channel power ratio rejection, so to speak, when you do this particular test, and you're not measuring numbers anywhere near what they state. Did they just simply give you words? Did they simply just give you words, or did they really describe by a functional block diagram or a good set of words that give you a mental image of a good functional block diagram what test equipment was used and how it was configured when they did that test? Did they really tell you, from your point of view, how they did that test? Did they give you enough information, Joe, that you'd be able to really duplicate it exactly the way they did it? Back to you, Joe.
Simple answer, no.
Yeah, that's a big conflict here. Because when it comes to high dynamic range measurements, the worst case situation I know of is the intermod measurements for passive intermodulation distortion that requires a cell site. And that is, I think, essentially every single brand of cell site requires that all equipment external to the enclosure, all feed lines, jumpers, circulators, inline amplifiers, antennas, and whatever, should meet 155 dBc third order intimod from a pair of plus 20 watt signals. A severe test. And some attack in one other company has produced some instrumentation that can do that. And without following their exact functional block diagram, or some very close equivalent to it, you don't stand a chance to get within a stone's throw of that measurement. That's a very tough measurement. So what you're describing is not quite that tough, but still, I can see what you're running into. Every reasonable signal generator has spectral purity noise side lobes that are going to interfere with the test. Let me drop. In other words, 25 KC away in a 10 or 15 KC resolution bandwidth of that particular bandpass filter of the real on-channel channel. Within that chunk of spectrum, the side lobe noise power from your signal generator is going to start dominating. And to blame the receiver under test for the noise that's coming out of a signal generator, of course, is unreasonable. So by either by very exotic bandpass filtering, or rather exotic bandpass notching of the noise coming out of your second signal generator, notching out the noise that falls onto the on-channel frequency region, without doing that, it might be a very difficult test to do. So I can see how your second signal generator, unless it's nearly perfect, is going to have trouble doing it. The possibility exists when they ran the test. The two signal generators were not even frequency synthesized. They were crystal controlled oscillator assemblies. In some cases, that's the highest spectral purity you're going to get. Start off with a 500,000 Q quartz crystal, put it into a very high quality oscillator, into a very high quality amplifier chain. Do that twice for the two separate signal generators. But even then, you might have to do some adjacent channel notching and filtering, bandpass filtering and adjacent channel notching, in order for the noise out of the signal generator number two not to be dominating the bandpass of the on-frequency channel. I think you see what's going on here. And by way of your spectrum analyzer, if you've got a good one, SiteMaster or whatever, you should be able to find out exactly what is the amount of noise power across each fraction of a kilohertz of the on-channel when the signal generator number two is set on the off channel. There should be a way you can map that and know whether or not it is above threshold of that particular channel. I would start doing that, and that's going to tell you either how many decibels better your signal generator number two has got to be, or it's going to tell you how many decibels of notch filter you're going to need in order to carry out the test. The V2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, how can you notch something that's 25 kilohertz away if you want to notch a primary generator from one to the other? How are you going to do something like that? You're so close in frequency at the band you're talking about.
Yeah, if you're doing this test at, say, 450 megacycles, and 25 KC away represents an extremely sharp filter, very, very difficult to do. The only way to do that I can think of that might work would be to do it at a lower frequency, as if it's the first or second IF strip of a receiver, and then heterodyne it up with high quality oscillators and low noise amplifiers. I didn't say it's easy. When you need very sharp filtering, like you and I use when it comes to our final bandpass filter of our final IF strip right in front of the discriminator limiter assembly, that's got to be done at some lower frequency, 10.7 or 455 KC, for instance. You may have to do something like that in reverse. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, so it sounds like in the short of it, with the instrumentation I'm using, I can't be absolutely certain of the spectral purity of either generator, so it makes the test kind of invalid. I do understand what you're talking about with a pair of crystal oscillators. having a much higher Q initially, so they would probably generate a lot less noise. I don't know if you know, another type of generator might have access to, like an HP generator, would be any better. Something like in the order of like an HP 8640. You know anything about those? Those things are pretty good as far as making a channel, adjacent channel measurements, as far as spectral purity would be concerned.
Yeah, I got no idea.
I just happen to be servicing a Hewlett-Packard 8640 as we speak. I've been using a pair of them to do a kind of two-tone test that requires very high spectral purity. But whatever signal generator you're using, the lucky thing for you, Joe, is you're in the business that gives you access to SiteMaster and similar kinds of Inritsu test equipment, which will allow you to plot the noise power in the adjacent channel that is coming out of your signal generator number two. You can measure the exact noise power out of your signal generator. It's going to take a little bit of smart to find out how much of that noise power you measure into the on channel is coming from the spectrum analyzer and how much of it is coming from the signal generator. It's going to take a little bit of smarts to do that. But step by step, there's a way you can measure what you've got to find out how much grief you've got. Go ahead, Mel.
If we take the receiver and knock the gain of the receiver down, or reduce it, so that to the minimum threshold of being able to put the service monitor, in other words, get everything to the minimum threshold, to maybe try to marginalize the noise generated, and then in some real quiet area, possibility you may be able to make somewhat of the measurement, Dick, over.
Yeah, which you may have said the right thing, Mel, but you may have said it backwards. When you have enough preamplification gain in front of a receiver, so that it has the highest possible sensitivity, it usually is the opposite of gain starved. It's really liberal on gain. As such, its dynamic range is decreased. It takes a much smaller signal to saturate a receiver that's got 20 or 40 dB of preamplification on the front end. In many cases, when you want to maximize the dynamic range of a receiver, you remove low noise preamplifiers and or put pads in between certain stages of the receiver. Now you can make a receiver that can tolerate strong signals, but it doesn't have ultimate sensitivity. It can't have it both ways. It can't have a receiver with the best possible sensitivity and the highest possible dynamic range. They're a compromise. They're in conflict with each other. As I've said so often before, it's like asking for an Einstein brain inside of a Raquel Welch body. You can't get that combination. I'm dating myself by saying that, but you know what I mean. So, he could maximize the dynamic range of his receiver by taking away preamplification and increasing his signal levels. And that may make an improvement. It may not. But he has the instrumentation to quantify the exact amount of adjacent noise power, sideband noise power, that's coming out of the signal generator. I didn't say it's easy, but he has the resources to make that measurement. Back to you, Mel, first. K2KEY?
H-U-R-I-W. Go back to the old days, you know, darker days. Even with that, I can say Hewlett-Packard even recommended many times use the minimum signal required to make the adjustment. And also, a lot of the old timers always with anything, whatever receiver they were dealing with, whether it be the early HF type devices or into VHF and UHF, they all agreed that riding the RF gain was the best way to, you know, remove unwanted interference. Just, in other words, just applying enough RF gain to make the desired received communication stick over.
Now you're talking. Back in the days before we had a real product detector for single sideband reception, and we used our ordinary CW VFO, continuous wave beat frequency oscillator, and we would tune that beat frequency oscillator to get Morse code reception. If you carefully tuned that system, you would get moderately good single sideband reception, if and only if you were riding the RF gain control with your manual fingers on that knob. And if the QSB came along and the signal sideband signal got a little bit too strong, it would overpower the amplitude of your beat frequency oscillator in the final stage of the IF strip, and pretty soon the single sideband would start sounding like Donald Duck. So minimizing the gain to maximize the dynamic range for that particular environment. It's a little bit like adjusting the elevator. I mean, the weakest signal is the bottom of the elevator floor, and the strongest signal is the top of the elevator ceiling. But how strong is your particular signal in that environment? You gotta make the elevator go up and down to get it within the right region of your particular signal or group of signals you're trying to measure. So that's sort of what you're doing with that RF gain control. A modern day receiver has a real product detector, which means it's got the equivalent of a beat frequency oscillator that's got a zillion dB of gain to it, and it also has a fast acting automatic gain control to a single sideband reception system. You put that all together, and all of that manual tuning and RF gain riding we used to have to do on an old receiver that wasn't designed for single sideband reception, all of that problem has gone away. I'll bet you on some of the early Collins receivers before true sideband product detectors were put inside, I'll bet you a guy using one of those early ones had to be pretty busy on that RF gain control. Is that approximately correct, Mel? K2KEY, KQRIW?
I'm using the Collins 7584, as I mentioned, that I've been working with using the saving loop and into the QRS flush. And the reason is because I wouldn't take a chance with that amount of power with a resonant antenna going into a solid state type of receiver front end. I believe that it may just do some damage. But with a tube, of course, receiver, it's more forgiving. So I find that riding, even though the Collins 84 is a very well-designed receiver for single sideband, primarily for single sideband, even though it doesn't receive AM very well, I find that riding the RF gain, if I got a nice signal, whatever the signal is, I mean, if it's 5.7, 5.8, whatever it is, I just bring the RF gain up just to where it's comfortable listening. And that goes a long way. Of course, the Q multiplier, that too, you know, there's also a factor. I know Q multipliers, manual Q multipliers have sort of gone the way of, like we say, the dinosaurs that we always talk about. But I'll tell you something. You take a lot of the old circuits, the old receivers and all, when you added that Q multiplier, you can really see a difference because it really peps up something. Sometimes things that you thought that, you know, they were ready for the junk pile over.
I believe it. Many of our modern-day circuits have certain improvements, but you give up a little something in the process. Rarely do you get everything without giving up something. Modern-day synthesizers have really taken the problem of drift of a receiver as it warmed up and almost made it go away. And a real good synthesizer, although it has no drift, can also have extremely good spectral purity of its local oscillator that's injected into the mixer stages. A real good one can do that. There are a lot of frequency synthesizers and a lot of receivers out there that are nowhere near that good. The frequency synthesizer that's inside of a Kenwood TS711A, 2-meter all-mode rig, and that synthesizer moves in 10 hertz steps. That's a synthesizer. You study what the schematic diagram of that thing, and the first impression you have is, why the hell has it got so many stages? What's going on with that synthesizer? You study it and you realize it's very busy. It's got a basic frequency region of, I think it's about 1 megacycle, or maybe it's a 0.5 megacycle. And it resets itself every 0.5 megacycle and shoves in another oscillator downrange. It's a synthesizer with inside of a synthesizer, you could say. But man, that thing is really something else. They put a lot of effort into that particular voltage-controlled oscillator phase lock loop system. A lot of effort went into that. Extremely quiet. and one of the most bulletproof receivers I've ever seen on sideband reception on 2 meters that doesn't have a tracking filter front end. It's got a wide open front end that's at least 4 or 5 megacycles wide. The old Yaesu first synthesized rig that came out in the, I think it came out around 1975 or so. 227, 225 BC. I can't remember the model number of it, honestly.
T1R.
Say that again, Rich.
T221.
That's the one. FT221R, I think it was. That had a tracking filter front end. It covered the 2 meter band in 600 KC chunks. So I think it was about 8 chunks or 7 chunks on the main range switch in order to walk your way all the way across the 2 meter band. That was a bulletproof receiver. But as you can tell, it was a very complicated tuning procedure to choose the right frequency region of the 2 meter band. It didn't tune continuously, so to speak. You had to select which portion of the band you wanted to go to with the main range switch before you started tuning the main dial. But because of the inconvenience of that, it wasn't popular, even though it was very high in performance. The Kenwood 711 came along after that and did an extremely good job within the receivers that have a wide open front end, as I say. And if you're willing to put in a Q multiplier like a tunable RF bandpass filter in the front end, you could make it probably 20 or 30 dB better than it already is. So that particular receiver, the Kenwood 711, does a beautiful job of surviving the dynamic range decrease that happens when you put a 20 dB gain low noise preamplifier in front of it. Noise figure wise, it needs a preamplifier. I'm not sure, but I'll guess that the basic receiver barefoot has got a noise figure of 8 or 10 dB. Nothing to write home about. But with a good guess that AR squared in front of it, you can bring it down well under a dB. Anybody have any questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call at us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Joe, am I correct in saying W2RYY that you do have access to test equipment at your soul mine, which will allow you to measure the noise sideband of your particular signal generator? And I know you can go to the right website where you will find out what is the spectral purity of that Hewlett-Packard signal generator you just mentioned. 8640? I've forgotten the model number. Over to you, Joe.
I just threw that number in there because I know I have access to one. Actually, a friend of mine has it. No, I don't have this access to the soul mine. And you mentioned a lot of Ann Ritchie's stuff. The only other thing I have access to, is, as far as Ann Ritchie's stuff, is a SiteMaster. Nothing else better than that. The only thing I have of my own that I could use to measure something like that, and I don't know really how reliable it is or how good it is, I have a HD 8594E, I think it's 8694E, something like that. And it has a 200 hertz bandwidth EMI option in that analyzer. Do you think that's capable of measuring what I want to measure?
You got to be careful now. At first you would think that using an extremely narrow filter on a spectrum analyzer, resolution bandwidth, is going to allow you to see close-in noise. And there's a yes and a no to that. A narrow res bandwidth filter properly used will allow you to resolve the fine detail of the peaks and valleys of the noise. If, for instance, there's a 60 hertz sideband and a 180 hertz sideband due to a power supply somewhere, that's the good news. But when you're measuring noise, in general, narrower bandwidth does not give you an advantage. If you're measuring a signal that is super stable, with a receiver that's super stable, yes, the more narrow the bandwidth when it comes to resolving a signal, the narrow bandwidth definitely helps. But when you're measuring noise, it does not. Because whether you measure the noise as minus 80 dBm in a 1 meg filter, or you measure it as minus 110 dBm in a 1 kilohertz filter, that's the exact same amount of noise. half the bandwidth of the filter to half the amount of noise you measure. I will admit that the very wide skirt of a 1 meg filter is going to make it very difficult to measure any closer than 1 meg away from the center frequency of an oscillator. So the skirts of the filter can hurt you. There you want to use a narrower filter. But when it comes to really measuring flat noise, lots of people fall into the trap of thinking that a more narrowband filter is going to allow you to measure the noise better. If you want the noise to be measured accurately, and if the noise is somewhat flat and doesn't have a steep skirt, I know you've got a steep slope to the noise on the sides of an oscillator, but if you were measuring flat noise, the most accurate measurement you can make is with the broadest filter you've got, followed by the narrowest video filter. Now you can resolve extremely small changes in noise because you get a very smooth curve on the spectrum analyzer screen without it dancing. That's exactly how a radio telescope radiometer works. Very broad pre-detection bandwidth, very small post-detection bandwidth. That really means a very large integration factor. As long as your receiver is not drifting in gain, and there's ways you can take that out with the synchronous demodulation, but as long as your receiver is not drifting in gain, you can measure 0.01 decibels of noise rise when you go from state A to state B, and therefore you can sometimes measure the amplitude of a signal, which might be noise. You can measure the amplitude of a signal.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can measure the amplitude of noise. That is as much as 30 decibels weaker than the noise of the front end of your own receiver. That's what radiometry will let you do. If you're smart enough in the way you use radiometry, I can take a receiver with a 1,000 degree Kelvin front end, and I can accurately measure the amount of noise power coming out of a star that, when my antenna is aimed at the star, is only giving me 1 degree Kelvin. With a good radiometry technique, I can resolve 1 degree Kelvin in an environment of a 1,000 degree Kelvin receiver system. Radiometry will let you do that. Broad bandwidth pre-detection, fine bandwidth post-detection, properly used, particularly with synchronous demodulation, will allow you to do that. So, one way or another, I think there are ways you can evaluate the noise of your signal generator. And when it comes to very quiet signal generators, that 8640, I think, is the model number, the one you mentioned earlier. It is a so-called free-running signal generator. And at first you'd say, well, it's not synthesized, it's going to drift like a banshee. It is an extremely quiet signal generator. It does have a little bit of drift, but it's got a freak lock loop system built into it as part of the counter. It's got a counter built into the front panel, and after you get to the frequency you like, satisfied by that counter, you press the upper right-hand button on that counter, and it goes into the lock mode. And it keeps using the counter to adjust the frequency of its oscillator to keep it on station. Beautiful system. Much quieter than almost any frequency synthesizer. And if the signal generator wasn't warmed up enough, let me drop. If the signal generator wasn't warmed up enough before you put it into the lock mode so that its basic frequency drifted out of the lock region, that whole system will tell you that because it flashes the signal on that screen. You'll get the same count, but it will flash at you, telling you you're out of lock. Don't believe it. You unpress that number, you readjust the oscillator frequency, you get it on frequency, you press the lock button back in, and the system is happy after that. That's one hell of a signal generator. The only complaint I've ever had with that particular signal generator is it's got a whole lot of 1 microfarad, 35-volt tantalum capacitors inside. Every so often, one of those will become a short circuit. Doesn't do any damage, because all of the voltage regulators in there are the fullback current-type voltage regulator. And the light-emitting diodes will tell you exactly what supply you just lost. Like mine, a couple of weeks ago, lost the minus 20 volts, and that particular light-emitting diode went out. It took me quite a bit of troubleshooting to find the right capacitor buried into one of those assemblies. And there are smart people who do servicing of those signal generators that will just simply replace all of those 1 microfarad tantalum capacitors. Just get rid of all of them. And it's a bit amazing that they should be failing, because these are metal canned, glass, insulated, sprayed brand name, 1 microfarad tantalum capacitors being used at the 15 and 20 volt level when they're rated for 35 volts. That was a quality product in its day, being used in a conservative manner. They shouldn't be failing. It must have had some kind of a bad production run, as I see it. And with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2RAW in the TechNet.
K2RAW.
K2 Yankee Oscillator. Start off with your name, sir, and then your question or comment. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. Bernie here. Just a further question on those signal generators. I've been looking at one to add one to my bench here, and I've noticed they come with 3 different options available. One of the options, I think, was a higher sensitivity oscillator. One of them is some protection in case you transmit back into it. And the other one was, what's the other one? Oh, it extends the time base all the way up to roughly a gigahertz. Just curious to hear your opinion of which of those options are really useful as a ham just kind of tweaking his own equipment, and which ones really are just money not needed to be spent. K2YO.
Yeah, I think the basic signal generator goes to something like 512 megacycles, 600 megacycles, 550, something like that. And there's an option that gives you a frequency doubling, which brings it up to 1,000 and some odd megs. In my opinion, that's an extremely useful option for 2 reasons. One, I've used it at 900 megs a whole lot, and I'm not sure now, does it or does it not go to 1296? I'm not sure. I'll double check on that one. So that option is very good. The high accuracy oscillator, which is more parts per million of accuracy, that's kind of useful. Not mandatory, but kind of nice. But for a guy who's willing to go back to WWV periodically and calibrate his 10 megacycle reference oscillator, you can get around that one if you want to save some money. The protection circuit that protects you from transmitting back into it, that one doesn't strike me as required. But that's just me. When I'm using a signal generator, I rarely use it in the close proximity of a high-power transmitter where I'm likely to transmit back into it. But I can see how people might run into that. When you buy that double frequency standard, which I think is the Baker version of the signal generator, what frequency does it go to? Is it 1,024 or is it 1,300 megs? What if you happen to remember the frequency? Back to you, Bernie.
It's marked 1024, but I was running it at 1090 on Wednesday.
Okay, and what's the model number of the SIGGEN we're talking about? Because I'm so darn forgetful. Ed, go ahead.
HP8640B. You got to realize these things are 20, 25 years old now. You're buying them on the surplus market.
When you buy one of those from eBay, in my opinion, you can get an awful lot of bang for the dollar. Me and my buddy, 6 months, 8 months ago, bought a pair of them on eBay. I forget exactly what we paid, a few hundred dollars for each one. They came in very good condition. They came with the CD-ROM, which is the service manual for every one of the versions. My biggest complaint was the service manual had so damn many pages and so damn many foldouts and so damn many versions that took me a month of Sundays to find the exact page for my particular signal generator, but it was all there. So, you may be a little bit against older equipment, Ed. Some of the oldies but goodies. I mean, here I'm using a Kenwood TS-711, bragging about how good it is. It's a 1975 piece of electronics, isn't it? It's going on 30 years old. And except for its size, it's got a built-in 110-volt power supply. It's quasi-portable, full all-mode, single-sideband rig that will transmit continuously from 140 to 150 megacycles, with a synthesizer of 10 hertz resolution all the way. That's a piece of equipment, by my standards. I'll admit it's only got 30 memories. And to some people, it's nowhere near enough. And it probably doesn't even contain a scan function, but I'm not sure. It does have something called TCS mode, which maybe was digital coded squelch, which the FAR, far cry from the, what is it, OnStar or something like that people are talking about now. So some of these older pieces of equipment are darn good. That's a 8640. There are people who think there are very few signal generators that have any higher spectral purity. And with that freeclock mode of its counter circuit, it's got all the frequency stability I could use. And I can set it every 10 hertz or something like that. Some ridiculously fine setting. Over to you, Ed, for any further comments on that. Mr. EAV, KQRIW.
WB2EAV, Dick, you completely misinterpret. You are making it sound like you can order one of these from Hewlett-Packard. I was just correcting that. I love the 8640. You should see the hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment I passed up until I saw the 8640 and said, that's perfect, I'll use that. As far as the transmitting back in thing is concerned, I don't know yet, but it's very possible I really could have used that on Wednesday. Dick?
Now, when you choose an 8640, are you at the salt mine going down the instrument room where you've got thousands of pieces of equipment and you pick up that particular one? Is that what you mean? Or are you saying you were at a flea market and you said, that's the one I got to have? Over to you, Ed.
I was at the salt mine. I wouldn't say thousands of pieces of equipment, but quite a bit of equipment. And I was asking, what do you got? I wanted 1090 CW. And the guy goes through the list, and when he gets to 8640, I said, stop right there.
Well done. You used it at 1090. What's your gut feel as to how much higher it might go, even though it's beyond its rating? Go ahead.
Take a close look at your thumbnail. Turn it sideways.
Okay. I think you're saying you've run out of string and that's about it. It's rated 1024 and it goes to 1090 and be happy it goes there. Okay. Everything has an end. Bernie, you got any further comments on all of this?
No. Both of your comments have been helpful. One thing I can add is I've looked at some of these on eBay and the, shall we say, the trifecta of options 1, 2, and 3 tend to carry quite a bit of premium on the order of like $200 more to get all three of them. But there are a number of them that have, say, two out of the three or one out of the three that are going at quite reasonable prices. There are people who are selling, I'm going to say, refurb units or equipment houses that are selling them with, calibration and, warranties, et cetera. But I think I'm just going to pick up one that from another somebody like you or I that's just using it for fun and wants to sell it. So, thanks for your input. I'll go back on the side. K2YO.
Yeah, Bernie, if you have a little bit of gumption, were you willing to open up the cabinet, void the warranty, not worry about the scorpion inside with the year's supply of food, and are willing to fix things? The fact that you are buying something that's calibrated, traceable to the Bureau, and warranty for 6 months, I'm not sure you need that. If you get that for an extra $10 or $30, go for it. If it's going to cost you $150, I'd be a little more reluctant. For people like Ed, you and me, most likely you can fix anything if you're willing to take the time. That piece of equipment, many portions of it are made to be easily serviced. Lots of plug-in cards, lots of light-emitting diodes telling you exactly what power supply is working and how well. I am guessing that 95% of all the failures that occur in that signal generator are because one of the power supplies is not putting out the right voltage. And that particular light-emitting diode on that power supply going out tells you right away, that regulator tells you that that regulator is not putting out the right voltage, and that puts you on a trail immediately to start tracing down the motherboard lines. What I literally did was go to my millivolt meter, on my digital voltmeter, go down the copper traces of the motherboard, find out which one was drawing high current, and immediately found the shorted capacitor in the right assembly, in one of the printed circuit boards that was a plug-in to that assembly. So troubleshooting, to me, on that particular unit is relatively easy. The only failure I've had is that the slide switch on the lower left-hand corner, which allows you to select CW, AM modulated, FM modulated, pulse modulated, and whatever, that little slide switch has come apart. I'm about to disassemble the front panel and see if I can glue that back together. I'm still getting those settings, but I have to put a sharp, pointy object in there to move the internal mechanism because the little pointer that sticks out has disconnected itself. I think it's the plastic glue has dried out, and I'm going to be re-gluing it, I think, when I take it apart. That's the only failure I've had other than this troublesome 1 microfarad tantalum capacitor inside of the output power amplifier assembly. But I've heard many people claim that very few signal generators have higher spectral purity. I have tested it with modern-day power meter, in RIT2 power meter, traceable to the Bureau, and I have reason to believe that its output attenuator, an absolute power output, is within a couple of tenths of a dB on every one of the settings. In other words, you set that thing at the 0 dBm, minus 13 dBm, or minus 47 dBm at any frequency you like, and it gives you, within a couple of tenths of a dB, that exact power at the front panel. And we bought a pair of signal generators that were not We bought a pair of those signal generators that were not in warranty, not guaranteed to be calibrated, except for the built-in, except for the supply of the CD-ROM for the service manual, all versions of the service manual, which had been copied from somewhere, but a very good copy job. Except for that, we got no warranty with it, so to speak. We didn't pay very much, many dollars, a couple hundred dollars each one, as I remember. Something like $300 each one. Don't remember the exact number. But from my point of view, we got a lot for our money. I'm very happy with them, having used them now for essentially 8 months. Anybody else with any further comments before we go over to Paul to find out what's going on in space? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
K2KY.
Go ahead, Mel.
No, the problem is your packet. They don't support their product after a point. I just had a situation not too long ago with a Hewlett Packard 8600, 8601 series, and needed a part for that thing, and forget it. They don't even want to know it even exists. You're going to have, you have to start hunting around and try a chance of finding what you need. It's so small because nobody's going to break up an instrument if it's good, you know, for that part. So you literally almost have to buy another one to put, make two out of one over.
I am curious, Mel, what is 8601?
The 8601 was from 100 kilohertz, kilocycles, so 110 megacycles, speed signal generated with a digital marking system. Nice piece of equipment, which is very good for aligning, you know, working with FM, AM receivers, and it was just generally a nice readout on it, too. See, it was a fairly well-made piece of equipment if you look at it. I'm surprised, I guess, I guess you wouldn't, most likely you wouldn't run into such a thing like that normally. But, it had an internal 1 kilohertz modulation system for AM or FM, and it had the sweep output that was very, very linear, and it was great for evaluating filters, crystal attenuated, and even doing some antenna work there. Nice overall, nice piece of equipment, the 8600 series, Dick, over.
And Mel, what was the component that failed that was hard for you to replace?
Two parts that failed. Number one, the readout went bad. It's a screwball specialized readout. I don't know what the heck kind of a contraption that was with it. In case what they did, the backlighting, you know, they used to do that in the early versions, the backlighting for the digital readout, you know, was some of them were internally, in other words, the lamp was, believe it, incandescent, you know, that long filament, and it was, it's built into the assembly, not a separate piece, stick over.
for a guy who is very crafty, is the way you can slice in there and put in some other kind of illuminator, Mel?
Probably not. The way it's a glass encapsulated thing, it's very fragile. You look at it, you can see, because it's just completely glass enclosed, the whole entire piece. It's not like, it's not a plastic assembly. It was a glass assembly. And they won't even tell you who the heck they got it from, who the vendor was originally that made that part. So you're stuck with that. And what else? There was something else that I needed one to find, something else we looked into, but I think we were able to get away with that. I think to control that multi-turn, 10-turn pot on there with the radix, but get around that, clean it up as best as you can. But without the readout, ruins that piece of equipment there.
Absolutely. And I guess you could find the individual leads to the readout and make an auxiliary readout, but I'll admit it's going to be quite a bit of work. No fun. Was the readout something like liquid crystal with a real lighting to it?
Early version of it. This regenerator goes back a long, long time. It was a, well-made thing, no doubt, had that that very high resolution, that six-digit readout, and it had a very high resolution, and, you have packet guaranteed 0.05% frequency stability, and of course, nice part, you could, the frequency of any marker could be read while sweeping, simply by pushing the marker control. And the marker accuracy was plus or minus also 0.05%. So had a lot of sweep stability in it. And, originally, at the original brochure, you found with, you'll never need, according to Hewlett Packard, quote, you'll never need another AM/FM sweep generator than this one. That was their advertisement at the time. It came with the right on the front of the instruction book over.
That is an interesting brag. Well done. When you're using it as a steady-state signal generator and not sweeping, is there a way you can use the counter by pressing a button and put it into the free clock mode to fix it into one exact frequency?
Was the derivation. I think this was the first of their generators that did that, Dick. I believe this was the beginning, the 8600. I don't know. Did they have one before that? I'm trying to picture. Was there one before the 8600 that did that? I don't remember. I'm trying to picture. There's so many instruments that we went through and all that I can't picture before the 8600 if they had anything like that offhand. Over.
What's sad is I was using the 8640D signal generator for a couple of months and living with some slow drift as it warmed up because I didn't realize it had that free clock mode. There's a very innocent little button in the upper right-hand corner of the counter assembly until I was reading the service manual and happened to come across that page. I never realized what that thing can do, and I started using that function. I said, my goodness, have I been putting up with grief for no good reason all these years, all these months. Okay, let's see what Paul's got to say. What are those astronauts doing out there, Paul? I was told by one of the websites, I guess, that astronomically speaking, tomorrow night is somewhat interesting. A crescent moon at sunset will sweep through a constellation of the Pleiades, seven sister stars. So with your binoculars, go out there and look at the crescent moon at sunset tomorrow night and watch the individual Pleiades stars wink in and wink out as they get occulted by the moon, and watch them sweep through the mountains of the moon, so to speak. So, if you go to, is it NASA.com? No, can't think of the name. Space Weather, I think it's spaceweather.com. They'll give you a nice article about that. WS2N, KQLIW in the TechNet. Don't forget about the beep every couple minutes.
Okay, Dick, very good. I was told a long time ago that the Pleiades officially is not a constellation. group or whatever. I don't know. Which is kind of like true. I looked it up one time. It wasn't listed as a constellation. Yes, I got a few things here. Did you ever hear that Pleiades is not a constellation?
It doesn't surprise me. Pluto is bigger than Mercury. Nobody doubts that Mercury is a planet. All of a sudden, we've decided that Pluto is not a planet. What in the world's going on here? So, you can use some exact definitions from past history or whatever, and certain star groupings, you can give them a different name. You can give them an Arabic name, an Egyptian name. Doesn't matter to me. Greek name. You can say it's a constellation. You can say it's a non-constellation. It depends on how the average astronomer or amateur astronomer treats it that really counts. So I'm not too upset by that. I'm mildly upset by the moon being declared a non-planet. Back to you, Mel. I mean, Paul.
X-planet number 9.
It's now called, what, a planetismal? Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good, Dick. Well, it becomes a problem because of the computer program that I have to find everything in the sky during the day or night or whatever year you go to. It's an old program, and you look up constellations and you click at something like that, and where is it? It's not there. It is not on the computer. So, to me it's an important group. In fact, the Subaru constellation, the logo on Subaru is the Pleiades. That's what they use. Japan got the great, good idea to use the Pleiades for their symbol. If you look at the car, you can tell they got the stars laid out like that. Well, the main stars, it's really hundreds of them if you look through binoculars or a telescope. This week, I think it was Wednesday, ATV, automatic transit vehicle, built by the European Space Agency, docked with the International Space Station. The name is Jules Verne, they gave it a name. And this thing brought up over 7,000 pounds of food and water and fuel, clothes, just a large quantity of stuff that they need up there that normally is brought up on a regular basis by the Progress ships by Russia. They always send one up every 6 months or so. Well, this thing went up there and docked with the space station, and they opened a door, went inside, and they're going to spend the next couple of months bringing over 7,000 pounds worth of stuff into the space station. It's three times the amount of cargo that the Progress can bring up. It also has the feature to boost the space station to a higher orbit, similar to what the Progress does. So, European Space Agency launched this thing about a month or so ago from the French Guiana down in South America on the Ariane 5 rocket, and put this 22-ton payload into orbit. It stayed in orbit for what, 3 weeks or so, 4 weeks, waiting for the space shuttle to dock.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
It's got big solar panels on there, and they expect to build about six more of these things. Each one will have a different name. Built by Italy, part of the European Space Agency program. That that's their contribution to the International Space Station. So I thought that was pretty interesting. That has an automatic docking maneuver set up to most of the Progress ships, where it comes in with radar and the lasers come on and it docks automatically. Day before docking, they tried a couple of times purposely not docking with the space station, testing the abort rockets on the Jules Verne, which everything worked fine, so it was coming close to the station, and then would back away as if it was aborting. And then finally, this week on Wednesday, they docked the they docked that spacecraft. Yeah, Dick, I wanted to mention to you the this is actually on TV about the Large Binocular Telescope, how it's coming online now down in Arizona, Mount Graham, southern Arizona. They built this thing. It's been under construction for half a dozen years or so. But they started designing it 20 years ago, and it's finally complete. And they say it has the ability to resolve galaxies, whatever it's looking at, 10 times the capability of the Hubble Space Telescope. So it's pretty amazing. A lot of people say, well, we don't need the Hubble, but now you have two telescopes doing the same work. And of course, they could be pointing at different locations in the sky at different times. This has two gigantic mirrors there, like 8-meter mirrors, they said, each one. But it makes the equivalent like it was a 22-meter mirror. It's got the system that it uses is the interferometry that they use. They've got this hermetic is what they have, imager, that's what they call it. So you also got an object spectrograph and a near infrared camera and spectrograph. So I read that it had a cost of $120 million to build this thing, and it weighs 600 tons. I mean, I think each glass itself is, I don't know, 4 or 5 tons of glass, and all the equipment surrounding it, building turns, it all comes out to about 600 tons. So, pretty interesting. At least Hubble has something to work, with, especially if they don't rescue Hubble on, later this year. They'll have this thing kind of like a backup. Yeah, Dick, the next space shuttle going up, STS-124, and scheduled May 31st, the main mission is to bring up the Kaibo Part 2 of the Kaibo assembly. Equipment being built by Japan, another big lab, their contribution to the space station. And also I want to mention, if you saw 60 Minutes tonight, Dick, they had a good piece on the future American space program, plans on going to Mars, of course, back to the moon first by 2020, to the moon. And they showed the competition program, they showed the Ares rockets, and they had all the favorite people on. Steve Squires in charge of the rovers, let me drop it. In charge of the Mars rovers, Opportunity and Spirit. And they had Eugene Cernan on, last man on the moon on Apollo 17. He spoke for a while, and then of course Michael Griffin, the amateur radio administration, and NASA administrator. And they interviewed him as well. Wonder if you caught that. It was the third piece, the third part of the 60-minute television show. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Yes, I did catch pieces of it before. I had a bunch of phone calls, so I didn't get it all. However, Steve Squires is an interesting guy to listen to, and he certainly put a lot of his blood, sweat, and tears into Spirit and Opportunity to make sure that they worked well. I'm always a little mystified when I hear prognosticators, future predictors, talk about manned mission to Mars. You guys have heard me talk before that they all seem to be thoroughly ignoring the consumable problem, the fact that I, as a human being, consume an amount of oxygen, water, and food that takes up the volume of my house in 1 year, and approximately the mass of my house. And I would need three times that just for me to survive for 3 years on a mission to Mars and back. Without some huge breakthroughs in recycling procedures, there's no way you're going to put that amount of consumables on board. You're not going to bring up an ATV every couple of months to a Mars mission. You're not going to bring up a progress ship every couple of months to a Mars mission. So they keep forgetting about that minor detail. It's not so minor. When it comes to the binocular telescope, beautiful sounding piece of hardware, a pair of